and brightest day, in blackest night, all other podcasts tremble in fright. Losers cower before the power. Orange is lust, and blues you can trust. Indigos feel, and white ones heal. Yellow scare, and green ones dare. That sapphire love and black hands glove will rock your foundation without hesitation. Chad and Mars face evil's might. Respect their power, for they'll make you see the light.
Hi, everybody. I'm Chad Bokelman.
I'm Mark Marble.
And this is the Lantern Cast.
Episode 572.
That's right. Tonight we're talking about some more absolute power with Green Lantern number 15.
Yes. Yes, indeed. There's no doubt that this is an absolute power tie-in, since it barely has anything to do with what's going on in the actual Green Lantern book.
which is interesting, because this may be my favorite issue in a while, to be honest with you. We'll get into it, but just, you know, very briefly, we've been talking quite a lot about like how the Lord Premier Tharos thing keeps dragging and dragging and dragging. If it's going to keep dragging, it's nice to get a reprieve, I guess, every now and then from even having to think about it.
I can understand that mentality, but and there are some things in this issue which I do like as well. But yeah. That being said, all this is doing is kicking the can further down the road, because this is already a storyline that has gone on way too long. And all this issue guarantees is, well, there's another issue we know what's going to go carry on into, because it literally does nothing with the Tharos plot at all. But
that's true. I guess we'll have to talk about it here in a second. So we have this issue titled Dogfight, from writer Jeremy Adams, penciler Fernando Pissarin, inker O'Clair Albert, colorist is Romulo Fajardo Jr., letterer Dave Sharp, cover artist Ariel Colon. And then we have our variant cover artists and editors and assistant editors and the like there. We open where we left off after Absolute Power number 3. And for those of you playing along at home, I'm just going to say it because, I said I'd mention it. Basically, all we need to know from Absolute Power 3 is that the heroes have gathered over on Themyscira. Those who are left to gather to come up with some sort of a plan. There's lots of different plans enacted. Nightwing's kind of taking over leadership here. But basically, Hal is just there to, you know, help hand out all the weapons that he brought over with him when last we saw him. He is still shirtless, so it's a little funny for him to be standing. Nightwing is standing, you know, up along with Mr. Terrific and Hal to his right. In front of all the other heroes, addressing him and telling him the plan, and Hal standing there in jeans and a boot and with no shirts. It's just shirtless handing out weapons. But anyways, the important thing here is Nightwing gives Wally, Flash, and Hal a mission to go to the Hall of Order and ransack anything they can bring back intelligence-wise, specifically on the Amazos. So that's their mission that Nightwing handed them out to them in Absolute Power number 3. So they are off leaving Themyscira on this bike to complete that. Hal is taking the reins there just because we know he likes to pilot things. And speaking of piloting things, they go over to an island that is apparently owned by Batman, because billionaires own islands, where he has stored a couple of pieces of tech of his, including a prototype plane called the Batwolf. It is apparently supersonic, stealth capable, and it's, according to Hal, one of the best planes he's ever flown. But it has a low flight time, and he says, plus if you accelerate too fast, it makes this weird noise and it kind of explodes. So they decide that they're going to gear up with the Batwolf And Wally's going to take his bike down, and they're going to go down to the Hall of Justice or the Hall of Heroes. But as Hal climbs into the Batwolf, Barbara Gordon, Oracle, comes on and just says, "Hey, why are you in Hangar X?" The Nightwing is saying this cool. He's, "Did you just deactivate the kill switch?" And he's like, "Yeah, you know, you guys are so strategic, it makes you predictable. See you on the other side." And they go flying off. Meanwhile, over in Coast City, Dawn Granger, a.k.a. Dove, is trying to save a family from a wrecked vehicle that is currently on fire. But since the whole world is against heroes right now, she is having the mob surround her and throw things at her while she's trying to save them. Carol Ferris arrives in her Star Sapphire getup to put a bubble around them, protect them, and help her put out the vehicle fire and move the vehicle away from the wreckage so that the mother and child occupants can get out of the crashed vehicle. They introduce themselves and they say they should probably get out of there, and they start to fly off, and she says she's going to take her to the Tower of Fate, to which she says, "I can't go there because, well, we assume at least it has something to do with the fact that Hawk and Dove are connected to the Lords of Chaos and Order, but we can't really get that too far with that because suddenly Dawn is overcome with grief and sadness and crying. She doesn't know what's going on. And suddenly Nate arrives as our sorrow lantern to confront the two of them. Meanwhile, in Washington, D.C., Hal is on approach to the Hall of Order. And of course, the Batwolf, like many other Batman devices, doesn't have any offensive capabilities in terms of bombs or anything like that. So he decides to use the spare Batmobile inside of the storage of the Batwolf to launch it into the Hall of Order and set off its defensive measures like an EMP cannon. While Wally speeds in to put a T-sphere on one of the data ports inside the Hall of Order. Meanwhile, the Hall of Order explodes and Major Force is there.
This fucking guy.
To stand there and act accordingly. He's got some headgear on. He's very robotic, I guess is the word, with his phrasing there. He's very clearly in control and taking direct orders from Amanda Waller. And he's standing by for even more orders. Hal tells Wally it's time to get out of there. He does. Meanwhile, over on the island nation of Gamora, Alan Scott, who is still imprisoned, is having a conversation with the Jade Stone Amazo, and he's basically telling him destruction begets destruction, but you have the ability to choose to do something else, and only you'll know what it's, you know, what that moment is when you get there, basically. And that's when Jade Stone gets the notification that Hal has broken into the Hall of Order. Back in Coast City, the Sorrow Lantern is going head to head with Carol. I'd say and Dawn, but Dawn is just kind of useless throughout this whole thing. But they confront each other and he says, you know, "Now you feel it, what you've done. You feel the pain of sadness. And this sadness changed me when you went back to him. And after everything he's done, after all the heartbreak and the tears, you still go back to him. Why? Because I love him." She erupts with violet light. "I need to let the world know that the only reality is the sadness it holds, and that's what I must do, what I must share." He lashes out and flies away from them, and she realizes she needs to help him. Hal is piloting the Batwolf back over to the crater where he discovered the Earth Lantern. Central power battery, I guess, is what we'll call it for now. Major Force is tracking him down, but just as Major Force is about to rip the canopy off of the Batwolf, Jade Stone arrives having made his decision and takes on Major Force himself. And then the Batwolf makes the telltale sound that we alluded to earlier, and apparently that sound is whoop whoop, and he goes, "There's that noise, it's about to go off." So he launches his eject seat out as the Batwolf explodes, and he is tumbling down and down and down and down. And this is when Jeremy Adams takes the opportunity to make a reference to the Green Lantern animated series. As Hal is falling towards the central power battery, he does a speed run of the Oath in an attempt to charge his ring before he hits the ground. But he doesn't actually hit the ground. He is caught by the Jade Stone, who lowers him down to the base of the battery where Hal cops a charge. And Jade Stone says that the battery is basically speaking to him, telling him to become its protector like a Tom was before me. Hal charges up, but Carol meets him down at the base, and basically they catch up, and she says, "I've met all the heroes. I'm understanding what sacrifice is and why you run off all the time. I want to be a hero too." And he says, "Well then, Star Sapphire, it's time we save the universe together," and they fly off together. And then meanwhile, in our backup, we get an epilogue to Green Lantern War Journal. Same creative team as before with War Journal. Basically, there's some rebuilding and some Steelworks related work going on here, in terms of what John was hired for through Steelworks. They're putting together kind of an airway, an air tram. He's doing it with Ellie. They're talking about basically everything that has gone on. It's an epilogue. There's not a whole lot revealed here. There are suddenly some machines attacking the track, because Ellie is just kind of riding on the tram, taking it around the block and everything. And he's worried about her. And she says, "Hey, don't worry about it. There's more coming up behind us." So they take on the other machines, and John is scared that she's going to hurt herself, and he tells her to stop the train, and she says, "Don't worry about it." And she actually gets rid of the machines and rebuilds the track, and everything goes smoothly. And John has a conversation with Steel about, working with family and, the fear, I guess, that comes with potentially putting them at risk. Especially during a time where he talks about how he has a target on his back now that he has the Dark Star ring, as well as his other, godly powers. He's got more attention on him than ever, and how can I put them at risk? And Steel's talking about how, his revelation was that Natasha was going to do this whether I let her or not, so I might as well let her do it in my orbit so I can keep an eye on her, kind of a thing. And they just kind of leave off with, "I can't tell what's in your future, but I think it's going to be big." And then it's a solicit basically for a Green Lantern Civil Corps special, which comes out next month. And that's it. It was a little longer than I wanted it to be. I felt like I was losing wind.
No, it was fun.
Yeah, what do you think?
I was going to say, I'm not sure where we should begin with this. Let's leave the epilogue to the end. Unless you really want to dive into it first.
I don't think there's anything to dive into. I think the only thing of relevance there was just like, I get the feeling that should have never been a backup. It should have been in the original series, whether we got 13 issues instead of 12 or what. I know you and I had a conversation offline, obviously, about it kind of feels like, yeah, maybe Philip Kennedy Johnson didn't have, an entire series in him, but he may have gotten his legs cut out from under him just a little bit in terms of the length he had originally planned. Maybe he planned just a couple of more issues and he ended up getting with a 12. And that's why we had to have the epilogue here and a backup. But it fits tone wise. It's just, I would have rather had a different backup. I just don't understand why it was here. And not
we don't need any backups. That's the point.
Yeah.
We're 15 plus issues when you count the extras and the specials and all the stuff. And like we already talked about once today, and probably the only time, because again, there's nothing to talk about Theros wise in the entire issue. Part of the reason why the storyline is destined to at least last a year and a half, if not getting closer to two before this wraps up, partially is because we lose pages every single month with backup stories. So you add up all those pages, that were definitely several more issues of story. We could be ahead at this point. If Philip Kennedy Johnson got cut off a little bit at the knees, it's still ultimately his fault, because again, that story dragged on too long. There were so many things that were repetitive issue after issue after issue. that he could have tightened it up. And it's not like he, and I still, and I, he certainly had a few months, I think, based on what it would seem, he had a, at least a few months notice that the book was ending with issue 12. So if he needed to retool something, I think he could have done it. Or there really wasn't much we needed here. The only thing of relevance in this to me, first of all, you get more of the confirmation that whatever the hell this really means, that that Shirley Stewart is the soul of John Stewart's ring now, which still sounds like he kind of saved her as a pope, because your ring shouldn't have a soul to begin with. None of these rings have souls because they have AI in them, but they're not alive. So I'm not sure what that means, and I'm sure we're not necessarily supposed to know what that means yet. But it doesn't. But it still reeks of playing God, as opposed to just, hey, I want my AI to sound, you know, instead of I want my Alexa to sound like Samuel L. Jackson. It's not quite that. And the fact that even though it's for the right reason in the story, again, because of the whole concept of playing God too, you have to suspect that the way Ellie was kind of like not. Was real quick to just at the end of the day disregard what John told her to do and do what she wanted. That's probably going to be a problem down the road. So that's going to come. That chicken is probably going to come home to roost later on because of just a hint that, oh yeah, oh, she was doing it for the right reason now. But again, right reason is subjective. So we will see what happens down the road. But yeah, I don't have much. I didn't think the artwork was that great in this story. I thought there were moments when it looked okay. John looked okay sometimes, but like John, Steel looked like shit most of the time when he's, especially when he's not in his armor, and doesn't look that great in his armor, honestly, either. But so I thought the artwork was a little subpar compared to the last two issues that we just reviewed anyway. Mm-hmm. And this very, very, very nondescript for Natasha and for John Stewart, because they just look like they have, I mean, for Steel, because of the fact they just John Henry, because they don't have any lines on their faces. It's just weirdly drawn. Especially when you see the birds flying around, and the birds have more detail than the faces do. But again, that's stylistically, you know, that's a choice, I'm sure, but still. So the main issue, it was okay. I mean, there were things in it that I liked. I kind of liked it jumping from thing to thing. I think that kind of worked here. Mm-hmm. I obviously don't really like it being so tied to Absolute Power, because A, I don't care, and B, I'm not reading it. And for the reason we already discussed, how it kind of like, it's another anchor slowing you down when you're trying to move the main story to its conclusion. The stuff with Nate, I thought, was the best part. That was interesting with the Sorrow Lantern's power, and the artwork is really good with him. He's got a good look. I kind of like that look, and I think I liked Hal being Hal, you know, being in his element, and the fact that, okay, goes back to the old days of Hal test flying his planes when he never wanted to wear the ring anyway, because there was a crutch, because he always knew that it was a failsafe, and he would not really be able to do his job properly or wouldn't be testing the plane correctly if he knew no matter what, if something went wrong, he was going to be safe. So this kind of harkens back to Hal's, you know, his natural skill set and his natural fearlessness, because of the fact that he's literally flying something that he knows it's very likely to blow up under the right circumstances, but like, what the hell? I got nothing better to do today.
I will say, though, because he doesn't actually say it outright, but this implies that Batman trusts Hal to test pilot some of his stuff for him, because he already knows what it's capable of. He knows, you know, basically he knows when it can go wrong, he knows when it's going to explode, he knows its limits, and he says, luckily for the first couple of versions I had my ring to protect me. So Batman asks Hal Jordan to pilot and test pilot some of his planes.
Yeah,
which that I think is cool as crap.
Yeah, it's cool conceptually, and in a way, and again, it makes Hal look better because of the fact that he's flying something now with a dead power ring. When, like you said, that he has tested before, having the failsafe of having a power ring that could save him, and he's still flying something that he knows is essentially a death trap, potentially, and more than just potentially, it's very likely that this thing is going at some point this thing is going to go wonky or blow up, and yet, you know, he doesn't really have much hesitation. So I think that's cool. We get a little bit of payoff with the stuff, but again, I don't know. I guess it kind of justifies Alan Scott being in a book a little bit, so we can have this Amazo. Now he actually, It seems kind of heavy-handed to a certain extent, or like, you know, plot contrivance. Oh yes, that he is meant to now be the new protector of the central power battery. It's good that it has one though, so I guess that's something. But Major Force, oh god, sometimes at least the character elicits the natural response he should, because when I was reading this and I got to the part and I realized it, and you realize it's Major Force, and that literally, like, I don't know if it was literally verbatim what I said a few minutes ago, but it was close to my reaction. It's like, because if there's one character that really deserves to die on page really badly, and I know they sort of killed him before, but I mean really killed him, Major Force is one of those characters. Yeah, Hal doesn't have the same baggage with him, but it doesn't. But still, it almost makes me wish that Major Force was involved in the destruction of Coast City, because seeing Parallax take this guy apart would be so satisfying.
But it's a risk, though, too, because he's kind of like Captain Atom, right? Basically, living energy, and if you let him out of his suit, he's going to explode.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. It's something along those lines is why he can't die. But there's, I mean, I'm sure there's ways that, you know, he could be contained, and certainly Parallax could have come up with something. But the reality is, yeah, Major Force is just one of those. He is just one of those villains that, but he does elicit that response. So I guess that's kind of good, because of the fact that, at least not for everyone, but out of all these villains and all these years ago, that initial intro to why you should really hate this guy, if you're a Green Lantern fan, so clearly if you're a Kyle fan more, but the fact that that response still kind of like bubbles to the surface, I guess that means that it was an effective use of the character back in the earth when Kyle was introduced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I enjoyed quite a bit of this issue. Even shitty Major Force and all. It felt good to be back in the action. See, I'm trying so very hard, guys, to let go of the absolute power thing, because, you know, it's DC's going to DC. They're going to do their event, and it's going to be crossing over with all the titles, win, lose, or draw. So we just got to take what we can based on this premise that we're forced to live in. And unfortunately, I might even like the event more if it wasn't what it was. Like, to me, you have fundamentally ruined Amanda Waller. Like, don't get me wrong, she wasn't one of my favorite characters in the DC universe or anything. I'm not harping on, you know, you ruined such a great character. But the thing about Amanda Waller, whether you liked her or didn't like her, was that she was so firmly in the gray. And I talked about this before, but like I've been reading pages of the main Absolute Power series and a couple of tie-ins here and there, where this woman seems like she's frothing at the mouth now to claim and claw and hold on to any amount of power she can, and to make sure her plan goes just so. Like, she is ravenous for power right now, and that to me, it just screams pure evil villain, not somebody operating in the gray and somebody who, you know, is taking, you know, orders from a government that that she is, you know, very patriotic and loyal to, and maybe going about it in a harsher way than others would, but is still at the end of the day trying to do the right thing or whatever. I don't get any of man, I hate this woman for what she's doing, but I can't really argue with her point that I used to get out of Amanda Waller, and I have none of that now. And we have made her a full out and out villain. And that whole premise just shuts me down. So when you put me square and start tying in my already ongoing series that I'm paying attention to with something that actively pisses me off, it gets kind of hard to enjoy things, which I think it speaks a little bit towards how much I actually enjoyed this issue, that I still came out of it enjoying it like I did, because we see Carol helping Dawn and an encounter with the Sorrow Lantern, and then Hal being Hal, and Wally saying things like, you know, Uncle Hal's the coolest, and like and of course that when they were piloting the bike over to the island to get the Batwolf in the first place, Hal asked to pilot the bike. those things were so cool to see. And Major Force being the pick is whatever, but it, you know, it's a kind of a classic villain, you know, beat 'em up type moment there. The Allen stuff, I don't know, you know, I guess it's okay to see him because he's trying to help guide the Jade Stone on his new lease on life and this will, this, not willpower, but free will that he's, coming to grips with. And you know, I'm very curious about how Jade Stone takes out, Major Force here, especially his little brain control thing he's got on his face, because it looks like Jade Stone rips it off, which I take as a good thing, because my big worry was that we just learned about this goddamn power battery and now we're going to put it in a position where Amanda Waller might figure out its location. I was not very happy about that, but it looks like that may be moot, so we'll see. And then, you know, you get the whole, all right, Carol Ferris, let's go save the universe together. Like, I want to be very clear. This last page here of the proper story of her going, I see your point of view. I need more than a page or a couple of panels here. I need an actual conversation between these two at some point of her understanding his point of view a little bit, and maybe it happens before we see her go off and join the Justice League or whatever, that she needs, you know, to experience that more and get that experience under her belt and stuff like that. And they need to have a full on conversation. But to me, the way these two have been interacting with each other, it's not resolved because of these little, you know, four or five panels here. I need a full on conversation between these two. I need more than this. I don't know what I'm expecting. All I know is I expect more than this. But that notwithstanding, I thought I was not particularly aggravated or annoyed at any particular section of this story. So I'm going to go ahead and call this one a win for me.
I mean, it's certainly generally speaking, I would have to say it's one of the better issues that we've had in the last few, because it's been pretty uneven over the last few issues. It's really been up and down. I mean, there's always something good, you know, so Jeremy always brings something good to it, it has been meandering. I don't think this necessarily makes it less meandering. It just makes it, it just kind of takes us off in a slightly different direction. It is one of those little, well, thank you, Captain Obvious things. When you have the last page and it says to be continued in Absolute Power number 4, and then it's finally here. Green Lantern takes a fight to the United Planets. Yes, finally. over 15 friggin' issues, but over a year and a half since the book started, and now we're finally which doesn't mean we're anywhere close to the end of the story. It just means,
because the fight's just starting.
That's right. I mean, I got to be honest with you. We already have the October solicits, right? So the reality is, I mean, I think, If this thing ends by Valentine's Day, I'll be surprised if this story ends. I mean, I'm really hoping, but I don't know. And it makes me curious what the hell they're going to do with the sort with. Are we not going to get any resolution to Nate's thing in Green Lantern proper? Is that going to be something that it's going to pop up in Justice League or something with Carol?
I thought about that too. Yeah,
that's going to be pretty shitty too. Not just because it relates to the emotional spectrum, but because they threw the breadcrumbs down here so much, and then especially this, it's like that is another part of the conversation they should be having. Oh, by the way, in case you didn't know, there's another Lantern Corps we hadn't even didn't exist before. At least we didn't know about it if it did. And guess what? It's my damn fault. It's all of our fault, you and me. I don't know.
Yeah. I think it's likely it'll be in Justice League. And I think it's likely, more likely than you think, just because don't forget we had Ultraviolet Lanterns appear and be explained for the first time and I think only time within a Justice League title as opposed to the main title. We didn't get much information on him, but the Gold Lantern in the Legion books and stuff like that, we've had the emotional spectrum explored in the forms of other lanterns wholly and completely outside of a lantern title a couple of times at this point already.
Right, but
this, I wouldn't be surprised.
But this, we at the moment, we have to assume this relates to why the what's going on with the emotional spectrum and why it's all screwed up.
Yeah.
So that is something that's is happening in this book. So I don't know. We'll see about that. I just let's see what I think. It's going to be really interesting to see what those October issues are like. Mm-hmm. This the Civil Corps special and the main Green Lantern issue to see what kind of again what kind of imprint War Journal is going to be making into this book, and even in the and even what the Civil Corps is going to be about and everything else. So I don't know. We'll see. Overall, I do think this was a plus, which is good since it's like literally the only Green Lantern book we have until that tangent thing starts up, which is soon. But I don't know. We just got we do need to move this ball further downfield.
Yeah.
It's just like we're getting a whole lot of three and outs.
The one final thought I had, and this is something with a healthy grain of salt and knowing that I don't have this idea fully fleshed out, it's very important, obviously, sometimes in DC Comics to read between the lines and read into things like, well, especially in a title like a Lantern book, color choices or fonts or things like that chosen. The font for the Sorrow Lantern was immediately recognizable to me as something familiar, but I couldn't put my finger on what it was. And to be clear, I don't mean the gray box with the white lettering. I specifically mean the actual font itself chosen for these letters here. This, like, you know, the O with the period in the middle of the O and stuff like that, and the kind of scripty look and everything like that. I am not saying that it for sure is this, or that I even have a theory of why it would be related to this. But the last time I saw that font used heavily and prominently, DC used it as the voice of the presence in the DC universe. And for those of you playing along at home who know your DC history a little bit, the presence is what DC essentially calls God in the DC universe. Well, as knowing, of course, that there are dozens of different gods in the DC universe, the closest concept DC gets to the Christian God, that's what they call the presence. And we saw quite a bit of the presence 10 years ago, which is why I think this is maybe a loose connection, because it was used quite a bit in the Phantom Stranger series around the New 52. It was used in the Trinity of Sin series that spun out of the Phantom Stranger series. It was used for a couple of John Constantine issues. But the font that we see Nate using here, not the color of the word bubbles, but the actual font, is the font used by the presence in the DC universe. I don't know if that means anything, because like I said, my examples I'm giving you are about 10 years old. It's entirely possible someone needed a cool font and saw that in DC's library of fonts and went, hey, that's cool, let's use that. But let's be honest, there are times more often than not when the choice of things like a color or the choice of a specific font has meant something about the hints to the origins of a new character or whatever. So is this Sorrow Lantern somehow connected to religion in the DC universe? I don't know. I can't really flesh out the idea of how would Sorrow be connected to religion and how would that relate to lanterns? And like, I don't know the next step of that potential theory, but I just thought it was interesting that oftentimes DC does mean something when they choose a specific font and they choose it with reason. And that's the last time I saw that font was the presence. So I'm not saying Nate is God or channeling God. I'm just saying there could be a connection there as to where this power comes from and or why. I don't know.
Yeah, we'll have to see. It's a possibility, but as we know, sometimes we read into things, but and not necessarily over not because we want to, but because, hey, we were like the whole fighting, like the whole the rage scene when they were fighting over Arizona, and that was completely luck of the draw.
Sure.
Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar.
That's true. So, but I did talk about that over on Twitter, guys. So if you're hearing this and you want to, what the hell is Chad talking about? I found several different screenshots from those books I mentioned, like Trinity of Sen and Phantom Stranger and stuff like that. And I posted about it over there with a couple of examples. So if you want to visually look at what the hell I'm talking about, you'll see what I'm talking about if you go to our Twitter account. But that's all I had left to add there, honestly. It's a very, very loose connection, but I thought it worth mentioning because it took me a good like 48 hours. I was like, I recognize this font. I don't know where. And then I finally figured it out.
That is cool. So I guess the October issues are going to be pretty important.
Yeah, such as they are.
Yeah, I mean, as far as our take on things and what, not just what we think, give us an early take on what we think the Civil War is going to be like, but the how we feel about what's going on in Green Lantern proper since we finally, quote unquote, not just get the fight being taken to the United Planet, but get back on track and not having our story disrupted for several months because of stupid absolute power.
Yeah, I'm very confident that the Civil War is just going to be whoever Hal gives rings to from this other battery, because as we know, there are people on Theros's side who can just touch you with a staff and disable your power from your ring if you're using a regular, quote unquote, regular lantern ring. So they need an edge. He's going to give other people the five or six or whatever other rings that are down there right now. Or who knows, maybe it's making more since the last, you know, he got down there and he's like, hey, start making more. I'll come back later. And now there's 10. I don't know. He's going to give lantern rings to somebody, and it's going to be Green Lantern Civil Corps versus the Green Lantern Corps. So, but we'll see.
Yes, that's all we can do at this point is we'll see.
All right. What's next?
Well, before we get to some feedback, because we actually have some and we've been sitting on it for, or it's been, well, I haven't been sitting on it for too long, but there's been a few things that have been building up, so we can at least get through a few of things. Let's catch up on what has Mark seen, because it's been a century, and I couldn't really fit it in last week. Correction, I could have fit it in last week because we didn't have an episode. I almost thought about doing, as we're recording this, I almost thought about doing one, doing a recording a couple of days ago, so we could have had something to come out the week of the 18th, but I just wasn't that highly motivated. So let's go through this quick. I don't remember the order that I've seen these in now, even though we'll start with Borderlands, because that's the oldest one. I unfortunately got suckered into seeing that twice, so God help me, yes. But no, it wasn't. All the negative things you heard about Borderlands, yeah, it was pretty much dead on. It's definitely a movie just to see when it's free. You see when it's free on something. It's not worth renting. It's not worth anything. Good cast. Didn't have much to work with for them, and I think so. That was disappointing. I thought Alien Romulus was good, but not great. I think it started off moderately well. I think the end kind of got bogged down, and I think some people were kind of summed it up nicely when it's almost like it's the greatest hits package, that they take things that worked well and reference things directly that work in almost every other Alien movie, including the prequels and things like that. So as a mini spoiler, if you were expecting that the Prometheus Covenant world was like not canon in this movie, no, it is. And you get, when you see the movie, you'll know, especially the last half an hour of the movie, there's absolute direct unavoidable cues and references to the prequels. I thought the cast was good. I thought it wasn't very original, though. There was one element with one of the artificial people, one of the droids, the androids, which is somewhat interesting, but I think from a character arc perspective, it is. But overall, I don't think it was the game changer that I think some people were hoping it was going to be. And it continues to prove that Alien as a franchise isn't particularly good at making a lot of money, because none of the Alien movies have made a lot of money. Prometheus, I believe, is the only movie that worldwide even came close to sniffing like $500 million. And this movie, I think domestically, is just still around $100 million. They're not big money makers. So even though this movie, I think, only cost 80, whether it's going to get a sequel or not, I think is kind of up in the air. So it takes care of that. Let's do Afraid, which is another AI gone wild movie. I didn't like this one at all, especially because there's so many AI movies out there. We've seen this going back to, which they reference in this movie too, going all the way back to like 2001, A Space Odyssey. And we've seen so many things like this, going Terminator, all these things about AI becoming self-aware and becoming a problem, that it's a genre we're really familiar with. So it has to be handled in a unique way. Even like, let's say, comparing this movie to Megan. Megan was so much better in how they approached it and what they were doing with it and everything else. So yeah, Afraid's another one. If you can watch it free, yes. I don't think it's probably even worth it, a rental, unless you get it to the point where it's like $3 or $4, and then maybe. I saw Cuckoo, which was another horror movie. I only saw it because Jessica Henwick was in it, and she was barely in it, so that was kind of disappointing. It's very similar to Watchers, which is now on Max. I don't know which one I think is actually better, but the concept is very similar. So I was not impressed with that either. And I guess I saw Beetlejuice, obviously. Beetlejuice. That's probably the winner of this group. I don't have a lot of ties to the original Beetlejuice. In fact, I just watched the original Beetlejuice the other day after I saw this one. So at least it still gives me proper perspective at connecting some of the dots. I had seen some of the original movie, the ending I had seen, but I don't think I had ever watched the original from top to bottom. So I thought Beetlejuice should have been funnier, I thought, but it still was entertaining enough, and the cast was good. Yeah, some of this, you know, there's a whole subplot line that probably didn't need to be in the movie because it doesn't really go anywhere. But it was a good cast. It was funny. And I like Jenna Ortega and anything, so that's a plus. And the last thing I saw was the Dave Bautista, The Killer's Game, which obviously tanked horribly. I thought for what it was, it was fine. I enjoyed it. It's another movie that had probably a better cast than it deserved to, considering the material. But I don't think for those who champion his range that this shows anything special about him or anything that he's expanded his range. But it's entertaining. It's he's a likable character in the movie. The concept, the premise is interesting. And it's from an action perspective. There's some cool action sequences in it too. So that's it. Now I'm caught up until we go see Never Let Go, which is tomorrow's movie.
Yeah, I actually finally finished The Walking Dead. I started a rewatch of that. I think I maybe stopped watching sometime after Negan, but before Negan was defeated, or basically right around the time Carl died. But I finally finished all 11 seasons of The Walking Dead, and downloaded a couple of more because Walking Dead has gone into a bunch of different spinoffs. One is following Norman Reedus's character, Daryl Dixon. So I got the first season of that. Then there was a season where Maggie and Negan team up, and that's called Dead City. They have to go to Manhattan. So there was that. And then I think there's another one where at some point, you know, spoilers, I guess, but at some point in The Walking Dead, Rick seemingly dies. And I say seemingly, that's what this other season is about, following where he ended up going and how someone ends up finding him. So I'm still on a Walking Dead journey. I have finished the main series, though. So I think Daryl Dixon has another season coming out that starts in the next few days. I'm not going to watch it as it comes out, but that means between Dead City, the Daryl Dixon series, and this other season about what happened to Rick, I've got 4 more seasons left. So I guess I haven't finished The Walking Dead yet.
Did you say you watched Fear the Walking Dead?
Did not watch Fear. Don't care for Fear.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know. I didn't think that I had missed that you talked about it, but that was obviously the most up until the Daryl spinoff. That was the most well-known one that kind of existed on its own. I think if anybody cares, which I think there's probably a small percentage of people that still care, that it'll, I mean, obviously Daryl Dixon has a fan base, but I mean, beyond that, I think it's going to be whatever they do with, but Michonne and Rick, that's going to be just because that thing should have been resolved a long time ago. So that's one of that, that was one of those really bad decisions as far as, oh yes, because remember we were going to get all those Rick Grimes movies that we never got. That's part of the reason why they took them off the show, I think, too. So it's like, well, that didn't really work out.
I will say, you know, towards the end of the series, one of my favorite relationships was probably that of Daryl and Judith. Judith being Rick's little girl. Well, technically, I guess Shane's little girl. But because Michonne goes, you know, Rick, quote unquote, dies. And then at one point, Michonne goes off to find him. So, you know, Judith is kind of left, you know, being raised by the community, I guess. But Daryl's, you know, caring for Judith, and Judith is just, you know, because she's young, she's a little girl, but she's also very smart and very cunning and ruthless and stuff when she needs to be. And, you know, she'll put down walkers and all this other stuff. He takes her out teaching her how to track and stuff like that. She's a pretty, you know, like her nickname when she was born, remember, was, you know, a little kick ass, right? That's what Daryl called her. And she's definitely a little kick ass. And their relationship was definitely something, the highlight, I think, of the later seasons of The Walking Dead between Daryl and Judith. So, I don't know. I wouldn't mind seeing more. Real quickly, though, before we jump into the feedback, there's some news in terms of figures, because we have an announcement that there's going to be not an official announcement, but basically we have seen now photos of a Sinestro Parallax. So when we saw Sinestro in the Parallax armor, we're getting a figure of that. It is a gold label figure. It is exclusive to Target, confirmed. When it comes out, we don't know. But we've also gotten photos. More photos are coming out of Effigy. So Effigy is on his way, coming pretty soon, which we knew from San Diego. And if you go to McFarlane's website, you have the option to go ahead and pre-order. I don't know if it's up yet or sold out. The Green Lantern figure, the collector's edition Green Lantern figure with the swappable heads, the regular version of it is Tomar Rey and Abin Sur. But the platinum edition, which is what basically McFarlane calls their chase, is the exact same figure. It's just that's the version. The chase will have the Arcus Chmuck and Green Man heads instead of Abin Sur and Tomar Rey.
Yeah, that's so typical that they once. Yeah, you're right. I don't know if we've ever. I thought we might have discussed that, but once it became clear that that's how they were doing it, that basically that one way or the other, that it was not, that it wasn't going to be where you were getting all the heads in one set. That basically it was either going to be the chase, or you would have to that kind of was crappy. Not surprising.
Yeah.
Not surprising.
I will say there's something interesting. The effigy figure, one of the photos that showed up recently on the group that Mark and I are part of with that Myron, the Green Lantern group on Facebook, the box for effigy shows a platinum edition sticker. So I don't know what effigy could be a chase of in terms of a different figure, or if he even is at all. I'm wondering if maybe McFarlane just puts out chases that aren't necessarily just different versions of characters, but just a chase of a unique, wholly one of one character. I don't know. I don't want to take up too much time speculating that, but it's interesting that the effigy figure has a platinum edition sticker on the box. I don't know what that means.
Yeah, that will be interesting to see what that means. I have been looking to see if keep checking to see if that Parallax Sinestro, when he becomes available for pre-order on Target, because I think I'll get that. At least they gave him a real Parallax symbol on his chest as opposed to those two versions of Hal. So I guess that's something. Plus it is a new head sculpt. So that's and the collector's the case, the sealed case with the chase is sold out already on McFarlane, which is all right, because I would not be I would not be ordering a case hoping I'm going to get the did they show us the back so we know it is Tomoe Ray?
I believe it was somewhere else someone said it's Tomoe Ray, or confirmed it was Tomoe Ray.
Well, there is a video. Maybe they'll say it in the video. It's interesting that I like the texture on the Green Lantern costume, but I do like, but again, that kind of follows what we've seen with Kyle. So, but it's interesting because the Abin Sur looks a little bit more like the Tamora Morrison version. Not quite, but it looks a little bit more. Yeah, that's, but that parallax one is definitely something that I want to get, but yeah, that is worth talking about.
Yeah, I just searched effigy on McFarlane's website, and right now it doesn't come up.
Yeah, so did I.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did too. Once I opened up the Green Lantern link, I did a search to see, and I did a search for Parallax for the hell of it too. We know it's a Target exclusive at this point, but that'll be cool. At least as a Target exclusive, we have a better shot of getting it. I think Walmart exclusives are really, really bad at getting, but at least the Target, I think we at least have a decent shot at getting it. That would be a cool figure. I probably would open that one.
Yeah. I wouldn't, but yeah, I definitely I'm gonna see it in person. Leaning towards getting it. Maybe not. It really depends, but most likely we'll see.
And when does the Green Lantern one come out?
Sure. Already backed off.
It's all right. I'm on it, and I'm still trying to see if they tell you when it's supposed to ship. I don't actually.
Usually they tell you somewhere in the title, but I guess not.
I'm trying to, because they have a bundle with the Dark Knight. The Dark Knight Returns and Huntress too for $76.47. You can get all three as opposed to just getting the one for like $30.
Estimate. Well, if you click the links from McFarlane's website where it says pre-order now, Amazon, GameStop, Entertainment Earth, Big Bad. I clicked on Entertainment Earth, and Entertainment Earth says October.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So that would kind of make sense. Maybe I'll get it from Entertainment Earth then, since depending. But either way, so those were worth talking about, because they're certainly. They have been making the rounds as far as at least having some, like we talked about from after Comic-Con, that we knew there were going to be some new figures coming out Green Lantern wise. So that's kind of, he's already pre-sold out on Entertainment Earth.
All right.
All right. So let's do a little bit of feedback. Lance wants polls. We'll have to talk about that. Regarding Discord, the gotcha. Idea of adding polls. His is more like the construct of the issue. Like almost like the player of the week. It's like, what do you think was the best construct of the issue? Which is a possibility, but just in general, I think polls related to certain issues would probably, if we wanted to drum up some more interest in Discord, I think polls are probably a good idea. Plus, it's good getting a snapshot on what people think about different, like maybe like. Instead of just like construct of the issue, it's like best moment of the issue, and give people an opportunity to vote on, given a few choices. But we can talk about that. That was just something that popped up recently. So let's do the War Journal one. Even it's the War Journal one might be the only one because it is kind of long. But it's somebody. But it's new feedback. It's a new person. So All right. So I'll read it. Hey guys, hope you're doing well. My name is Anis, and I've been listening to the show for more than a year now. I wanted to talk about War Journal and what you have to say about what I'll write. I binge read all of the PKJ Lantern issues and backups to see how they age, and it was unsurprisingly a better read than in single issues. But here's the thing. I don't think that the book was as bad as singles. It's not Black as Night quality, yeah, either, but a good book. The problem you've talked about for months now regarding the book, which is the inclusion of the gods and Olgrin in the book, got me thinking about John and what should be done with him to elevate his character. One of the things I thought about was Rogues Gallery and how of all the Human Lanterns that were created from DC's inception till DC Rebirth, John is kind of the only one with not one villain. Hal, Alan, and Kyle have rogues. Atrocitus has become Guy's villain. Well, not for a while, but yes, in the past decade. And even Jess and Simon have their weird new rogues like Black Hole Jane, which I've completely forgot about. But then again, we haven't seen much of them. Add to the fact that John is a godlike being and you get him facing the same problem Wonder Woman has faced for her entire existence, which is not knowing what to do with her rogues to elevate her and them, which lead to DC focusing on her god villains from the New 52 till Death Metal. And that saw various degrees of success depending on the creators and the stories they told. And the well-received stuff from that era was similar in the trade reading quality of the War Journal trade reading. For references, I'm thinking of Tynion's J.L. Dark, Robinson's brief run on Rebirth, Wonder Woman, and Azzarello's run, at least until recently, because of all of a sudden that run became polarizing in the last 4 years or so. Back to John, the characters that were fit to be his villains grew away from that, which is another problem. Carol's a Green Lantern ally exploring being a hero, and Yura was Kyle's villain and then became whatever she is now with John. In my opinion, if we want Lantern villains that are fit for a god, then we're limited to the entities and lore fleas, which is certainly interesting to see, but that's something for time to tell. Finally, about the self-serving nature of the book, I agree and disagree that it's the case. I agree because Olgren is a PKJ creation, but the disagreement comes because Olgren didn't matter in Action Comics. He was mentioned once, then it was implied in PKJ's last arc that Olgren wanted to possess Superman's youngest son. Then that got dropped after 2 issues or so because PKJ was rushing the ending. Interesting. And he tweeted then that he didn't get to do anything with Olgren in Action, so he'll repurpose the plot for War Journal. Maybe him tweeting that before War Journal coming out is why I didn't get annoyed by the issue 6 reveal, but that's another discussion. So technically, Olgren is more of a new Green Lantern character than a Superman character. His ties to Superman are so minimal that they're almost non-existent, especially that we didn't know or understand anything about Olgren until War Journal. Sorry for the long mail, and hopefully I didn't bore you with it to death. No, you did not. I don't think his explanation and giving more detail about how Olgren came to be is important. I don't think it makes it any less self-serving. I think it actually makes it more self-serving. It means he wanted to do something with Olgren. He didn't get to do it in War Journal. I mean, get to do it in Action. So he, for the next chance he got to do something with it, he went down that road because that's a story he wanted to tell. So it was less about it to me. It seemed, even with that explanation, it's less about it needing to be a Green Lantern story, as in, oh, I get to write another book and I have some time. So now I'm going to make this the Olgren story that I wanted to tell in Action, but I wasn't allowed to, or I didn't have the time to. So I think it still makes it self-serving. Now, and if it really wasn't a Superman thing, then why did he even bother throwing it into Superman? If it was really a Green Lantern thing all along in his mind, then why did he bother introducing it at all in Action Comics? But
well, I think it's interesting in that canonically, it makes it more of a Green Lantern thing because we didn't get to see what he had planned with him being connected to Superman's son or whatever like that. Just like, that wasn't in the actual pages. His plans, we've already talked about that. That's a different thing from what's actually in the pages. So it's interesting that we don't have Olgren on the comic page contesting what we see in War Journal, in that it makes Olgren more of a quote unquote Green Lantern villain because, again, canonically within the page comic itself, we didn't see really Olgren do anything else until War Journal. So yeah, it gives us something in terms of perhaps we'll revisit Olgren from somebody else in the future. And maybe that makes him more of a Jon Stewart or just Green Lantern related villain or adversary in some way, shape or form. But it doesn't make me any more or less excited.
No. And the background is relevant, but I don't necessarily think that it changes all that much as far as in the big picture. I don't think it just changes much. But I do think, as far as John being elevated, I think that is the problem. Also, is because currently the big thing for DC, probably in the post Adio world, is elevating John Stewart. That's obviously a key thing right now. That is the marching order or the agenda behind. They want John Stewart to be elevated. It's kind of becoming a variation on the how Kyle had to be special, even though that was more of a Kyle fan thing than it was a DC edict, obviously, because that wasn't going to be a big thing under the Didio regime, where the Silver Age characters were kind of being elevated back up again. But the point is, Kyle, how it's similar, just because how Kyle fans need Kyle more times than not to be special, because at one time he was the only one in town, and now that he's not anymore, he's got to have something unique about him, or else it kind of, like, somehow in their mind it takes away from the character. Which I get, but I think, but again, it's been so long now, it's like you got to move beyond it a little bit. It was a different era. I mean, you know, he existed for a reason as the only Green Lantern. So now that he's not ever going to be as special again. So you have to accept that, if these constant stretches to make him special can make him interesting, but you know it's not going to last, because eventually it's, which he touches upon in this email too, it's not just a makes him like Wonder Woman. John Stewart, it makes him like Superman. That's the problem Superman has, and a lot of people have writing Superman. It's like he can do so much. It's like, how do you have a villain that's worthy of Superman?
Well, like, yeah, but that was also the problem with Superman back in his original conception.
Yeah, yes, it's less of an issue now, it's still somewhat of an issue. But it's, yes, it's not like it was back in.
Well, the original solution wasn't necessarily let's up the game of his villains. It was let's give Superman weaknesses. That's how we got Kryptonite.
Yeah. And then eventually, obviously, depowering him so he wasn't nearly as strong, period, as he was. But it seems like now the thing is with John, he's got to be special. So it started with in the Thorn run, which I had less of an issue with, because at least it picked up on something that was already canon and then completely forgotten about and swept under the rug in Mosaic, the end of Mosaic. But now it's like he's an ascended being, and now he's kind of like split into pieces, which was, it's really dumb. You know, there's two of him, and we don't even have the real one technically. Ours is that's not even ours that we're reading about. And then you have, now he's got this other ring, which makes him, which is special too. And it's like, I think that's part of the issue too, is the constant need to elevate John Stewart. And we'll see. I mean, we know it hasn't worked so far. It didn't work really in the Thorn run. Not saying elevating him is the issue either. I'm just saying so far that hasn't been the trick. That hasn't been the trick to get him over the top, to make people care enough to read the book and to make him, which they probably would prefer him to be, the Green Lantern, at least on equal footing with Hal, even though sales keep telling you that that's really not the case at the moment. And Hal has the advantage of being Green Lantern longer. And even during this run, you know, Hal's been the main Green Lantern focused on since 2004, since Green Lantern Rebirth. So he's got 20 years on him now. So it would be hard to somebody to just automatically jump in and push Hal out. But I'm sure that the current editorial would probably love that to be the case if they could. But let's see what the Civil Corps stuff is. I mean, if it's going to be another group book where John Stewart's just leading a group, then maybe, because we know Green Lantern Corps worked when that was the case. If it's going to be another Green Lantern essentially solo book with John leading it, being the main one you're focusing in and on, issue in and issue out, jury's still out whether that sells, because he's never proven that he can sell a book, really. So the elevation, I think, complicates things on some level. It could make it cooler, because you could come up with bigger threats, but it also could, like he mentioned, it's like, you, how do you deal with the Russo brothers' problem? It's like, how do you deal with omnipotent characters? Well, we choose not to use them.
Yeah. But thank you so much for writing in on us. We really appreciate it.
Yes, that was a really good email. Let's see. Well, we can do Mark's because it's quick. Mm-hmm. Congratulations on your anniversary, Chad, Mark. Always enjoy your great content on all things Green Lantern and more.
Thanks very much, Mark.
Let's see. If you want to read Monty, I have no problem.
Did we play that voicemail ever?
Well, the voicemail's core ones.
Right.
That's a different one.
Okay.
But we have not played the one about Green Lantern 14. If you want to do that one instead, we can. I just don't have it I'll have to just listen to it again because I haven't done it, but it's up to you. Pick one.
Yeah, let's do it.
Let's do the core one. Okay.
Yeah.
Hey, fellas. Just read the backup in Green Lantern 14, and wow. I got some early Green Lantern core vibes from crap, I forgot his name now. The Green Lantern core book that launched with Johns. I mean, wow, it gave me that kind of feeling and gives me some high hopes. You know, hopefully this Civil Core or whatever that's coming is going to match this because Guggenheim and Derek Robinson did a fantastic job on his Shadow Lanterns backup. I mean, this is the stuff that we've been waiting for, and I'm really, really hoping more of this will come to the front. Can't wait to hear what you guys think. Later.
Yeah. I think I gushed enough about it in that episode, but I really enjoyed the hell out of that that backup. And he's talking about Gleason and Tomasi, right?
Yeah, I believe so. And yeah. I think that if he's talking about, you know, the era right after rebirth and recharge and everything. Yeah, the backup was good. It's just as we said, the problem is with a lot when the backup overshadows the main story, then that's kind of a problem. And that backup was really more interesting than, so it's a catch, like we talked about earlier in the episode. It's a catch 22 because we have the fact that we do too much of the Tharo stuff can drag it down because it's not something that we care all that much about, but we have to get through it to wrap the storyline up. But when you get another aspect of the story told that's more interesting than the main story, and again, that kind of shines the light back on what isn't really necessarily working or hitting on all cylinders, but the backup story was very, very good. And I think it's going to be what Civil Core is going to be like. I don't, but it's all speculation at this point. So yeah, we have to see.
For sure. Well, if people want to reach out to us, how do they do so?
I don't even have that open. Lanterncast@gmail.com. Lanterncast.com is the website if you want to visit us and see what we have going. I still have to put that that last ring cyclopedia cheat with the Mjolnir. I still have to do that. But that's the website. You can follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, #GLcast. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, whatever platform you listen to us on, please leave us a positive review. Last but not least, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail or a text, 708-LANTERN. Lanterncast Vids is YouTube. And of course, if you want our Discord information, just email us at lanterncast@gmail.com and we will send you that.
All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night.